Shabbat Shalom. So Jewish day school, Jewish studies in college, rabbinical school, a doctorate in history of Judaism. Whatever criticisms can be leveled against me as a rabbi, the accusation that I took shortcuts in my Jewish education is not one of them. Which is why, in retrospect, it's nothing short of astounding to me, and not without some degree of embarrassment, to publicly admit that I came this far as a Jewish communal professional without ever having visited Poland and Germany, as I did with our community just a few weeks ago. Chaired by Eileen Penn and Vicki Warner, and under the direction of Rabbi Savinor, oversubscribed at some 80 congregants, the week we spent together was perhaps the most profound Jewish educational experience of my life. Lest you think you misheard it, the most profound Jewish educational experience of my entire life. For the 10 days since our return, I found myself at a loss for words at how to describe the things we saw, the conversations we began, the community we formed, and the experiences we shared. Actually, just for, if you were on the trip, stand up just for a second. Okay, thank you. You may be seated. Each trip participant, each one of us, was moved by the trip in his or her own way. And I have no doubt that each one of us took away something different. This morning, I want to share my own personal preliminary reflections, a travelogue of sorts that I hope will lead to a dialogue in the years to come, not just on the places we saw, but on the themes and questions raised by our experiences and worthy of reflection as a community, both today and into the years ahead. Roughly speaking, the content, the themes of the trip can be divided into three units. Pre-war European Jewry, the destruction of European Jewry, and finally the seeds of rebirth in post-war European Jewry into the present day. First, pre-war. Remember, while Israel may be our birthright and historic homeland, the Judaism we practice, our laws, our literature, our music, are all rooted in Eastern and Western European Jewish traditions. To see the synagogue and the gravesite of Rabbi Moses Isserles, the great codifier of Jewish law in the 16th century of Krakow, for me was akin to visiting Plymouth Rock, or more accurately, Independence Hall in Philadelphia. In Berlin, we visited the cemetery where Moses Mendelssohn was buried, arguably the founder of the modern Jewish experience, the first Jew to carry a hyphenated Jewish identity. When we visited the Warsaw Cemetery, the final resting place of the great rabbi the Netziv, I.L. Peretz, Solomon Ansky, and so many shapers of the Jewish religious and cultural experience, history overwhelms as one engages in the heart of Ashkenazi Jewry. We visited the brand new Museum of Jewish History in Poland, in Warsaw, where we engaged in the world that once was, the nearly 1,000 years Jewish presence in Poland, Hasidism, the Reform movement, klezmer and cantorial music, all of it, so much of who we are as Jews, all anchored in the places we visited. The second theme, of course, was the Shoah. To walk under the gates of Auschwitz, to see the gallows, the gas chambers, and the crematoria, to see the piles and piles of discarded suitcases, the canisters of Zyklon B, the shoes, the human hair, provokes a visceral physical response like none I've ever experienced. And as much as a barbed wire concentration camp itself, I was struck by the presence of the home in which a commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Hess, lived with his wife and children just steps away from the site of genocide. How in the world, we wondered, and this is a point to which we return to again and again, could a human being become so desensitized, so devoid of empathy, so capable of absolute evil as did Hess and the entire Nazi death machine? Powerful as our visit to Auschwitz was, for me, there's something about the scale of Birkenau that transcends words. To stand, for me as a parent of young children, at the place where the selections took place, to walk on the same path as did so many on their way to the crematoria, to see the inhuman conditions in which so many lived and were ultimately murdered, the memorial service we shared as a group, these things I will never forget. These places must be seen by all. The day we visited the camps was perhaps the most emotionally draining, but to the great credit of Rabbi Savinor and the chairs, the scope of our study extended well beyond the horrors of the crematoria. As we stood at the Umschlagplatz, the Warsaw boarding station where so many were put on the trains to their death, as we stood at the site of the Nazi book burnings, we sought to understand the conditions and context that could give rise to the topography of terror that was the Third Reich. The camps we visited in Poland were in Poland, but their existence came by way of the Nazi regime. Were the Poles accomplices, victims, bystanders? These were complex questions we debated. We were all acutely aware of the narrative choices that were made at the museum in Warsaw, the Schindler Factory Museum, or the Holocaust memorials in Berlin, or for that matter, by our local guides, each telling, reflecting subtle and not so subtle points of view, each telling begging the larger historical question of where truth can be found. For that matter, we asked these difficult questions of ourselves. When we visited Mila 18, or the sculpture of Janusz Korczak, or the sculpture by Rappaport in memory of the Warsaw Uprising, we wondered whether our focus should be on the Shoah or on the Gvura, the destruction or the physical and spiritual heroism and resistance of those facing certain death. As with any story, what we choose to emphasize, what we choose to excise, these are all choices that say as much about us in the present as they do about the actuality of what transpired in the past. The third theme of the trip was post-war Europe. We visited the Warsaw Synagogue, the Krakow JCC, Berlin's Jewish Museum, amongst other tender embers of Jewish life. The story is not a simple one. If it were not enough that Jewish life in Poland and Germany was functionally wiped out by the Shoah, until 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, the odds of any outward expressions of Jewish vitality in Poland were slim to none. Nobody really has a hard sense of how many Jews there actually are in Poland, for a variety of reasons, least of which not being the lack of any conventional definition of who is and who isn't a Jew. We heard multiple stories of Poles now discovering a Jewish past kept hidden out of fear of the Nazi regime or the communist era. When we visited the Krakow JCC, we met a man named Mundek, who miraculously survived the war in hiding, his family having been murdered. You can only imagine the emotion we felt and not the insignificant sense of but by the grace of God, when Mundek sang a medley of Yiddish songs with one of our own trip participants, a shared Jewish past bridged across time and geography by way of music. As for Berlin, the story of rebirth post-89 is a fascinating one, a combination of reclaimed identities, post-Soviet emigres, expat Israelis, and otherwise. We celebrated Shabbat in the historic Oranienburger Strasse Synagogue, where we had the pleasure of seeing a young German Jewish girl celebrate her bat mitzvah, no different than how we would do so here at Park Avenue. We met with a group of rabbinical students poised to inspire the Jewish future. For me, having been raised on an aversion to anything German, These experiences prompted a fascinating paradigm shift, evidenced by my decision to buy my kids t-shirts and snow globes at the Berlin airport on the way home. It's downright curious to acknowledge that it's probably much better to be a Jew in Berlin today than in Paris. I'm not quite sure what to do with this realization, but the fact of the matter is that I'm looking forward to my next visit to Germany. Small, but scrappy and full of pluck, the Jewish communities we visited are making a go of it and are deserving of our support in both word and deed. Inevitably, our engagement with post-war Europe raised all sorts of complicated questions, not just for the Jewish community, but the non-Jewish community as well. With the passing of the generation of the perpetrators of the Shoah, how do Germans move from collective guilt to intergenerational responsibility? Who were these non-Jewish volunteers at the Krakow JCC? And what's prompting them to give of their time and energy to supporting Jewish life? Why exactly do tens of thousands of non-Jews turn out in Krakow every year for a Jewish cultural festival? In walking the Jewish neighborhoods of Berlin, the sidewalks are littered with Stolperstein, or stumbling blocks memorializing where Jewish families once lived. Are these isolated one-off gestures or reflective of a much deeper soul-searching of a new generation? So too, we engage with the question of how Europe's past informs her present. A group of us volunteered at a refugee center for Syrian immigrants recently arrived. By no means there exists a consensus on how to handle the humanitarian crisis engulfing Germany, but what's clear is that Germany is playing to a different standard than so many other countries who have closed themselves off to the refugees, a Germany well aware that the world is watching how their past informs their present policies. Underlying our entire trip was a question of the actions and inactions of the community of nations in the run-up to World War II, a question which we all know has ramifications for all of us today. Pre-war European Jewry, the slaughter of that Jewry, and the post-war narrative, it's far more that can be fit into any one sermon and certainly any trip. Time and again over our trip, I returned to a single biblical image, one that just happens to appear in this week's Torah reading, and that is what Moses spoke of, the binding of Isaac. The potential of Abraham's promised child, the ordeal of his binding and near sacrifice, and the post-traumatic question of how he reconstituted his faith in a God upon whose watch such suffering was endured. Neither for Isaac nor for European Jewry is the story a simple one. On the one hand, Isaac never really fully recovered, his faith somewhat muted as compared to that of his father Abraham or his son Jacob. On the other hand, it was Isaac who linked the generations one to the next, who despite his ordeal found the fortitude of spirit to see another day. The question of faith in a post-Holocaust world is a difficult one, and we should avoid the urge for facile answers. What I will share is that of all the powerful moments of our journey, perhaps the most unexpected one came when we left Auschwitz and stopped for lunch at the local JCC. Generally speaking, the 15-minute afternoon mincha service tends not to be the most awe-inspiring Jewish service of the day. And yet I don't believe I was the only one in the group who felt that it was that brief mincha service when we opened up our hearts and our prayer books just a few miles and minutes away from having visited the greatest horror humanity has ever known, that was perhaps the most powerful prayer service in which I have participated. Where was God during the Shoah? I have no idea. But what I do know is that my inability to answer that question does not immobilize my faith, but just the opposite. It prompts me to probe more modestly and more deeply, as I seek to understand the painful mysteries of what it is to live and be a man of faith in a post-Holocaust era. A final image, a final prayer service to recall. As mentioned, at the invitation of Rabbi Giza Ederberg, our entire community spent Shabbat in the historic Oranienburger Strasse Synagogue, the seat of German Jewish life in 19th century Berlin. Damaged in Kristallnacht, the synagogue was bombed and destroyed during the war and left in disrepair until the collapse of the Berlin Wall and partially reconstructed since. A lovely chapel from which one can make out the outline of where the monumental synagogue once stood. The rabbi and the cantor of the community graciously extended the bema to our own cantor Lissick, who led a beautiful Kabbalat service that night when she concluded, as we would hear, as we did last night, with the singing of the final verses of Psalm 92, Sadik Katamar. The cantor chanted, as I will call on her to do momentarily, the melody as composed by cantor Louis Lewandowski, the cantor of that very synagogue in the late 1800s. The psalm speaks of the downfall of our foes, of those who seek our destruction. It speaks of the planting of fruit-producing seeds, all the while affirming God's uprightness. It was a haunting gift the cantor bequeathed to us, to contemplate those words, to listen to Lewandowski's melody, to see the outline of the Jewish life that once was, and most of all, to share that moment in the Berlin Jewish community with the Park Avenue community, to share that moment in a collective Jewish community, a community through time and space, across the chasm of destruction, and now into a new chapter. That melody, that moment, that I know I will never forget. I thank Rabbi Savinor and the chairs for the life-changing experience. I thank the trip participants for the journey together. Most of all, I look forward to that day in the not too distant future when we will offer another trip. And once more, we will learn about our past, we'll engage with the unspeakable, and experience the seeds of renewal that is European Jewry. Shabbat Shalom. Cantor?